did I ever hurt you so? That if you still want to leave, won't you let me know? And I will try my best to understand. You see, it's kind of hard when a woman is losing her man. Don't I be blue, I'll just keep moving along. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's time for you to go. I said so long. Yes, it's time for me to go. I said so long. Time for you to go. I said so long.
Stuff. There is the sound, of course, of Johnny May Matthews and a tune called I Have No Choice, written by tonight's studio guest, all the way from California, Sharon McMahon. Hello, Sharon.
Hi, Amy. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us and just sharing your life story, really. What a very interesting life you got. I'm joined in the studio by Neil Pounds this evening. He's a studio guest choosing the balance of the music, apart from our little interview. Neil, say hello to Sharon.
Hello, Sharon.
Hi.
Great. So, yeah, you wrote... How old were you when you wrote that song?
I was 16 years old when I wrote I Have No Choice.
Wow.
And there's a little story kind of behind it because... I lived on Calvert, and it was a two-family flat, and I was sitting downstairs on my piano on a summer day, and I was just kind of fooling around a little bit, and my aunt lived upstairs with my other three cousins, and there was a jazz musician, Tucker Cole. He came on the porch and rang the bell to go upstairs.
Right.
But he heard me playing the piano, and he looked through the screen, and he said, can I come in and show you a couple of things?
Right.
And I said, yeah. So, because he knew I was a songwriter. So he came in, sat down, and showed me these jazz chords on the piano. And he showed them to me, and he had me play them, and he would play it. And when he was sure that I got it, he said, okay, I'm going to go now. And so he left.
Yeah.
So I kept playing those chords over and over again, and I loved the way it moved up and came back down. And so I said, I'm going to put a little beat to that song. And so I started putting a little soulful beat to it, and then I came up, and then I wrote the song.
Beautiful, and it's a great track as well. I went to a Rare Soul weekend last weekend in Skegness, and two people included that in the sets, and it filled the floor each time.
Brilliant. Yeah.
And, of course, it got covered...
Well, you know, the thing... Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, it got covered again in the 1970s by Black Nasty, didn't it?
Yes, well, that was actually Johnny May's son-in-law, I think, or son.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't
know that. It was actually recorded again on the Concord label, I believe.
Oh, right.
But Johnny, that song was not actually written with Johnny in mind at the time, because I hadn't met her yet.
Right.
And Ollie hadn't started producing her yet.
That's
so,
Oliver Clapton.
Yeah, Ollie had not. She had been doing a lot of work on her own. Of course, everyone knows that she had different record labels and doing different things. But Ollie, that song was recorded when he actually was working with her. So he's the one that introduced her to the song, and he had her come over to my house, meet my mother, and I played the song for her, and she loved it. And then she used to come over and rehearse it and learn it and have coffee with my mom, and we get at the piano, and that's how it got going. And then when she recorded it, they did it at United Sounds, and of course I was there to see her do it.
Fantastic.
But yeah, that's how it happened. And I love Johnny May. Johnny May was such a soulful, wonderful person.
Yeah, yeah.
She was fun to be around, and she could really, 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 she had soul in her voice.
She looked like a lovely lady. There's a clip on YouTube. I don't know if the listeners have seen it, but two of my friends went across to America and found her, Gilly and Tats Taylor. And there's some cine film of her on YouTube, her and her daughter, I think, in her kitchen.
Yeah, they're in the kitchen.
Singing along.
They're
fantastic.
In the kitchen singing. And he's playing. Yeah, I met Gilly
so
when I was there, too.
You met Gilly?
Yeah, I met Gilly.
Oh, he's lovely.
And Andy.
Tats, yeah.
Andy and Doug.
Oh,
and
right.
Andy and Doug drove us around. So,
oh, right.
Yeah, they drove us from London to Cleethorpes and everywhere and spoiled us and everything.
Yeah, and by Doug, of course, you mean Radio Newark's very own Doug Hall. Doug does several shows or two shows on Radio Newark.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Great stuff. So, I mean, Johnny May, that's just one of a host of tracks that you've recorded, that you've written for other people, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I started my career as a writer. I never intended to sing, but I got kind of stuck at the piano trying to... I would say, well, let me show you how this goes.
Right.
And then I'd have to sing, you know. But I wanted to share a little bit about how I did get my start with Ollie and how I met him, because a lot of people just don't know that part.
Oh,
they
yes,
just
please.
Know that I worked with him.
Because for anybody who doesn't
know...
Anybody who doesn't know, tell us who Ollie McLaughlin was.
Well, Ollie McLaughlin was a producer. He was a DJ. He was a publisher. He was a music man before I met him. Him and his brother Maxie in the 40s and 50s used to give big, big dances up in Ypsilanti, Michigan, and they had people like Billie Holiday. Ollie actually produced Dorothy Ashby. He did an album on, what was his name, Dave Brubeck.
Oh,
and,
yes.
So he was into the jazz thing, you know, back then in the 40s and 50s, and him and his brother Maxie used to give these big concerts. And so then he became a DJ. He was a DJ in Chicago when he was young. Then he went to the Army. Then he moved to Michigan, and then he became a DJ in Michigan as well.
Mm-hmm.
But he was living in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which was about 40 minutes from Detroit. So he ventured down to Detroit. He actually met Del Shannon, whose name was not Del Shannon at the time. I can't remember his real name.
No, I don't know.
But he saw his song, Runaway, and he put that Runaway out, and Runaway went to, I think, number one. And around the time I met Ollie, Runaway was out because I think it came out in 1961.
Right.
And I met Ollie in December of 61. I was 12.
Yes.
So, but what happened was I had written four songs.
At 12 years
old. Our culture was that we had to learn piano lessons. There were five of us, and it was mandatory. We had to take piano.
I had a similar upbringing. I had to learn euphonium.
Yeah.
Parents, eh? But now it stood you in good stead. So, I mean, you'd written four songs and you were only 12 years old.
I was 12 years old.
I mean, how for soul music to me is it's a personal, heart-wrenching experience put into words and music. How can you have had so much life experience to have written songs
what?
Like that?
I don't really know how that happened, because I would just come home from school and just kind of play around on the piano.
Yeah.
I was taking piano lessons and all of that, classical music and stuff, but... I used to put the radio on and then try to mimic the rhythm of the songs on the piano.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one I learned how to play was Mother in Law. I don't know if you remember that song. But anyway, I learned how to play that, and I said, wow, I can do this rhythm thing. And then I started thinking, well, you could probably make up your own songs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the idea started, and I'd come home every day and just kind of play around with the rhythms and start humming and getting the chords to match the bass line, and then I started making up melodies. So it just kind of happened, and I wrote those four songs. My cousin came home from the war. He was in the Korean War. He was like 26, 27. He had a friend named Marion Crawford. And he says, hey, he told her, he says, my cousin is wrote four songs. And she said, well, I know this guy that's in Chicago right now, and he's looking for some writers. He's trying to start a publishing company. She said, when he gets back in town, I'll have you bring your cousin over.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened. He she called him, and he picked me up and took me over there, and I met Ollie for the first time and sat down at her piano, and I played my little four songs, which I didn't know anything about music business or anything, you know. So anyway, he liked the songs, and he said, I want to come by and talk to your mom. So he came over to the house and talked to my mother, and that was in 1961. In 62, he recorded Gracie Darnell, So Long Lover, and The Bad Guys.
Wow.
And he started taking me to the studio, to United Sounds, every Saturday, and I'd sit there and watch the sessions, and I was getting to, you know, I was learning everything, and he was teaching me, and I'm meeting the musicians, and later I find out there's all the Motown musicians.
Lovely. Well, I'll stop you there. Let's talk about that after this next track, because you, as I say, you've been writing since you were 12, and you've written some really gorgeous music. One of which is a personal favourite of mine, Dion Jackson. Now I'm going to play "I Can't Go On." This is a 1975 remix, and beautiful, a little bit faster for a 70s crowd. But I'll just play this, and then we'll come back to you
perfect.
In just a moment.
Okay.
Without your love, there is nothing for me. Without your sweet, sweet smile, girl, happy I just won't be. My tears keep falling every day that you're gone, and baby, I can't go on. No, no, I can't go on. Yeah, you took my love. From deep down inside, one day you turned and walked away, girl. You made me forget my pride. I may be foolish to love you the way that I do, but without you, I can't go on. No, no, I can't go on.
Fantastic sound there, Dion Jackson and the 1975 version, available on the Contempo label at the time, and I Can't Go on the phone live from California. I've got the lovely Sharon McMahon, who wrote that song. Sharon, how you doing?
Yes, great, I'm doing great.
Great record. And that's just one of a number of tracks that that you wrote during your Detroit days. So
right.
you were telling me about as age 12 you were picked up by Ollie McLaughlin, and he enjoyed the four songs that you'd written at that age, and he took you into his recording studios, and just in doing admin and jobs around you used to work for him after school, didn't you?
Right, and he sometimes would pick me up from school. I'd say, "Oh, I got to go to the studio," and I'd come out of school, and he'd be there in the car. And I'd say, "Oh, we're going to the studio today." And he said, "Yeah, we have to go." So This is how I learned the business.
Yeah.
I mean, he saw something in me. I didn't know anything about writing songs or anything. And he just decided he was going to mentor me and just take me along. And so that this was an education for me.
Well, yeah, because you had a real comprehensive exposure to the business, didn't you? Because, I mean, just go through the sort of things that were in your remit at the time.
Exactly.
As a 16-year-old girl or 15, 14-year-old girl, you were, you were singing backing vocals, you were doing admin.
Right, right.
Publishing.
Right. He taught me all the publishing. And what happened was, because Ollie lived so far away from Detroit, he was actually coming in town 2 and 3 times a week, driving in. And by the time I got to, when I turned 16, mm-hmm. I think he was kind of tired of that. So he rented these offices in Ralph Tarana's studios at Terra Sherma on Livernois.
Right.
There were two little offices. When you open the main door, you come in, and to the left there were two offices, and Ralph and Russ used to rent those out. I think at one time Dennis Coffey had them just before Ollie got them.
Mm-hmm.
But Ollie rented those two offices, and he told me, he says, listen, I want you to come in, and I want you to, you know, take care of the phones and be here, and I want you to work here when you get off of out of school. So I used to get out of school then about 1 o'clock, so I would take the bus over to the office, and he would be there, and it gave him a place to conduct business in Detroit, because he was always there anyway.
Yeah, lovely.
So as he began to produce more and more of his acts, he got a Cool Jerk, and he had, and Dion would come by. I had met Dion already when I was like 14,
mm-hmm.
but everyone was coming into the office all the time. Brian and Eddie Holland, the Motown writers,
they
would stop by. The DJs would stop by. People would come by. I was typing contracts, answering the phones, you know. So I was exposed to a lot of the people, and I was available when he was doing sessions to do the background for some of those songs. So they would call me in. And that's me and Thelma and Joyce on the background of I Can't Go On that you just played.
Oh, right. Lovely.
That's Thelma Hopkins, Joyce Vincent, and myself.
Lovely.
And the original release that Ollie did, he made a mistake and sent the wrong master in.
Right.
And that's why the one that was released, you don't hear any background.
Oh, see.
But now on YouTube, you can hear that the one you just played, the remix.
Yeah.
That's the original background that we did.
Well, I never knew that.
Yeah.
Lovely. Because also you did background on another song that's really big at the moment, Belita Ward's Magic Corner.
Yes. Yeah, her manager, Petey Varner, he was a teacher in Ecorse, Michigan, and he was actually teaching one of my nieces in school. But he loved music, and so he was her manager.
Right.
So he came to Ollie's offices, and because Belita, I believe she had a deal with Ollie, so I would see her every once in a while. But they had booked a session. There was another studio. Ralph and Russ had built Studio B down in the middle of the block. So there was two studios, and that's the one everyone was using. So they went down that day to do the background, and Ollie says, okay, we're going to go do our background session. We'll be back. And I said, okay, I'll take care of everything. So I'm sitting there in the office, and the phone rings, and they call me, and they said, listen, we need you here for this one note. There's one note missing. You have to come and do the background with us. So I locked up the office and ran down the street and went down and did the background. And Pat and Diane Lewis are also in the background. It's Pat and Diane, Thelma Hopkins and Joyce, and myself. And Popcorn Wiley was in the engineer booth up there with Ollie and Mike Terry, and all of them were up there. And Russ Tarana was the engineer all the time.
Wow.
So, so we did that background, and that's kind of how it was. They would call me when they needed me, and, you know, if they needed a fill-in or they needed somebody. And sometime I would just do a demo. Like I did a demo of Do I Deserve It for Barbara before he, so he could give it to her so she could learn it.
Barbara Lewis,
brilliant. Yeah. So the people that I was associating with, they were coming into the office, and that's how I met Tony Hester.
Right.
Because Tony and Popcorn signed a deal with Ollie, because Ollie wanted more writers to write for some of the groups he was signing. He signed this white pop group called the Excels, and he also wanted Tony to write more songs for Dion. And so Tony was coming by the office every day, and we became really good friends. And we used to talk about our songs together and everything on the phone at night, ideas we were coming up with, and we'd go across the street and have lunch. And so then Don Davis sent Eli Fontaine over my house one day, and Eli says, Don wants a song for Mavis Staples. He's going to do an album on Mavis Staples. He wants to hear if you have any songs. So I play Eli some songs, and he picks one, and so Don decides he wants to do it. So Don records the song on Mavis Staples, stops by the office, and drops the album off on my desk.
Right.
And I was on the phone or something. I turned, he was just waving, and he went out. And I look at the album, and on the, I say, oh, okay, my album is out, you know. Tony walks in and picks up the album. And I was going to put it away because I didn't want Tony to see, you know, everything I was doing. Because sometimes you don't want to make other people feel like you're doing more than them at the time, whatever. So he saw it, and he pulled it out, and he saw my name, and he says, how did you get this? And I said, well, Don Davis. And he started calling Don, and that's how Tony got the Dramatics.
Oh, right.
Because Don told him, he says, look, if you want to work, I've got a group that needs some songs. If you can come up with something, then I'll let you produce them. And it was the Dramatics. So that's how Tony got the Dramatics.
Lovely.
So,
So in in the mid to late 60s. In 1973, you made a life choice.
Yes. Well, I actually left Detroit August 14th, 1972.
Right.
I had a 30-day excursion ticket because I was working. I had a job at General Motors, a very good job.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a 30-day sick leave because I wrote this song that I believed in so strongly that I felt it was time for me to leave home.
Right.
So I snuck away from work, and I got a 30-day ticket, and I came out here to Los Angeles with my book of songs, and I called a couple of record labels and told them I was a writer from Detroit and that I had some original material, and I said, I can't, you know, and they said they would give me appointments. They'd come on up. You can play. Come on up and play.
Great. Well, let's talk about that in a minute. I'm just going to play some messages, and then we're going to play your track from 1975, I think it was. Get Out of My Life.
It was released in 73.
73.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's coming up next. Radio New York.
Everything I do, you're living in a world where everybody's wrong but you. And hey,
beautiful from 1972. Then there's Sharon McMahon and Get Out of My Life. Sharon is on the phone live from California. Sharon, thanks for joining us.
Yeah,
great track. Now that was your first release on moving to the West Coast to sign for Columbia Records.
Yes, it was. I was very delighted to get the response I got when I did the auditions there, when I came here, and the producer that I ended up with was excellent, Toxie French.
Right.
He actually had been the drummer for the Fifth Dimension.
Oh, see. Yeah.
Prior to my meeting him, so he was extremely talented, and then I had the great arranger. It was Clive Davis's idea to have a Bobby Martin do the arranging for the strings and the horns. So Bobby, we wanted to fly to Philly for the session, for the string session, but Bobby wouldn't have it. He wanted to come to California.
Right.
So he ruled in that that little contest. But anyway, he came out and we had a great session. It was probably one of the last string sessions at Wally Hyder Studios out here. But yeah, when I left here, left Detroit, and you know, I decided it was time for me to leave. I wrote that song, and it was so inspiring to me. And I said, you know, you really need to take this song and leave Detroit. You need to.
Right.
It's time to go. So I believed in it, and I had a job. I was working at General Motors, and I had a 30-day excursion ticket. I said, I'll give myself 30 days, and if I don't make it and I don't get anything, I'll just come back to my job, and I'll work here and be happy and retire.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to get something going before, and I didn't have to go back, you know.
Great. Was there any difference, any cultural differences between Detroit and Los Angeles? Any was the lifestyle, is it more laid back? Do you get more difficulty in getting people to work to time? I don't know. I imagine Detroit's quite an industrialized, centered city, whereas Los Angeles, I don't know too much about that, but it just feels so...
Well, you know, back then, Detroit was... if the industry, if the attitudes in the industry were like they were back then... Everyone that had talent would have a chance to do something with it, because things were just so open then. If you wrote a good song and somebody heard it, and they'd just come up and say, hey, I want to do your song. Or the DJs would come in the office and say, what do you have? You guys have anything you want me to put on the air?
Yeah.
And so right now, everything is locked down. You can't get to the radio stations. You can't. Nothing's open. Nothing's free.
You see, that was my next question.
You can't even get auditions.
That was my next question. You've been in the music business over 50 years. You must have seen some huge changes.
Oh yes, and that's why my work right now is limited, because I can't do as much as I want to do.
Right.
I did get a chance to do some television, though. I did lyrics for NBC miniseries back in the 80s. I've had experience in different areas because I'm a very good lyricist. I'm good with words, too, and so I can use my skills anyway. But it's very, very difficult now. Everything is like, it's almost like it's prearranged who's going to make it and who's not. You know,
yeah.
It's no more, I'm going to try to make it. You can't do it anymore. You can't just try to make it. Internet is not enough.
No, it's all
Internet
about who you know, isn't
enough.
It? It's all about who you know.
Yeah,
you've got
to have
that
names.
Leg up.
Right. There has to be a system to bring you to the table. There has to be a way for you to, you know, take one step after another to get there. And now those systems have broken down. They don't exist anymore.
Well, I'm not sure.
You can't call a record label like I did. I call the record label. I talked to the A&R department. I said, I want an appointment. They said, okay, come on up, you know. You can't do that now.
No.
You can call mine.
So. Neil says you can call his record label any day of the week. Neil owns a UK label called 6ix9ine Records.
Okay, well, that'll make it for me.
We're open 24/7 whenever you want to come in.
Okay.
It's like, oh, how about an offer like that? Anyway,
sounds like I'm in the wrong country.
You are as well.
We can do a deal from there, believe me.
Right.
Okay.
I'm sorry, we need to break off to the news. Can you just wait for me 90 seconds, please?
Yes, I will wait for you.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Back with Sharon McMahon straight after this. Stuff. That's one of the more recent compositions of Sharon McMahon. Came out on, well, Sharon, tell us about it. It came out on CD back when?
Yes, my CD, the title of the CD is Somebody Else, but this song, Got to Thinking About You, is it's actually my favorite song on the CD.
Right.
Even though I love the title track, but I like the feel of this song because it talks about being under the street light, and I saw your car, you know, and I saw your car on the corner under the street light, and it you know, just made me think of growing up in Detroit when we used to go up under street lights and talk on a summer night and things like that. So, and I made sure that I included the things that people think about the most, or the things that people notice about people. So it starts out by saying, I saw a car that looked like your car.
Yeah.
And then the next verse talks about, I heard a song. You know, it was our song. So, yeah, I love that song.
Lovely.
It's
it
nice
is nice.
And warm.
Yeah, it is. It is. Got a nice sort of summer evening feel, hasn't it?
Yeah, yes. I really love the CD, but I wanted to mention that my producer was Preston Glass.
Right.
And Preston and I work very well together. And the song Got to Thinking About You, we actually share the writer's credits on that song, because when we were getting ready to go into the studio, I asked Preston, I said, do you have any tracks or anything that, you know, you haven't been able to write anything to or anything? And so he says, yeah, and he let me listen to a few tracks, and I actually picked two tracks from his collection, mm-hmm. from his library, and one of them was the music that you hear for Got to Thinking About You.
Love
the
that.
Other one was the music for Summer Living on the CD. So I wrote the melody and the lyrics to both of those songs, and it just came out so great, and we've worked together on a lot of projects. So, and another thing about Preston is his brother, Alan Glass, is a producer who lives in London.
Oh, right.
He's lived there for probably, I guess, 20 years.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And he flew in for one of my vocal sessions when I was when Preston was recording me. So those songs are really, really dear to my heart, and working with Preston is, that's my producer of choice.
Lovely. So
when I go back in the studio, he's going to be working with me on some projects.
Great stuff, because I was aware of Preston Glass, because he's been involved with Natalie Cole and Aretha Franklin, Anita Pointer
exactly,
as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Ralph T. had the last CD, the one that Olive Branch is on, the song that we were talking about before, Preston produced that, but he wrote it.
Right.
And then he had me do the duet with the other artist on there. And that was all a production from Ralph T's Expansion Records over there.
Ah, great
so
stuff.
So that's where that CD came from. It was called Colors of Love.
Right, I shall dig that
and,
one out.
Yeah, so it was a really great project to be a part of. There were a lot of artists on that project. So Preston and I are good friends. We work good together. We are right on the same page musically, and so almost everything we do comes out good.
Excellent, lovely.
So I'm really happy about it.
So are you still working with Preston at the moment?
Yes, I'm going to be going back in the studio. My next project will be with him.
Fantastic. Well, I do hope you keep us abreast of your product. Some great tunes.
Well, I'm really excited because I've written a few new things, and I'm looking forward to hearing them as a finished product, you know.
Lovely. So are we.
So, yeah.
So you're currently living in California. You're still writing. You're still making music. And you're still loving life.
Yes.
Good. So you brought out this CD in 2007, which is still available. Still
right.
In print.
Pardon me?
Yeah, I say it's still in print. It's still available.
Oh, yes, it's
so,
still available.
Is it available?
Right now it's at...
Through your
website?
It's
on CDBaby.com and other places. Mostly I sell on CD Baby.
Oh, right. Lovely.
So, and as a matter of fact, they had to... They contacted me and asked me to ship them another shipment because they were they still get a request for it. So I'm happy about that. You know, I worked hard on it, and I tried to present something and try to put something together that represented me as a writer and as an artist. And I think it came out good based on what I was trying to accomplish at the time. And but also, you know, I have plans to get back in the studio this summer, and I really, really want to do more of the Northern Soul songs,
Attention.
More of the songs.
Yeah.
I think that would be a good idea. And, you know, I could put I Have No Choice, and I could do Straighten Up Your Heart's Been Done, because it was on the CD, but some of the other songs, like the Deion Jackson song, you know. I've lost a lot of friends along the way, and almost everyone I've worked with. And, you know, you just feel like you want to do something to remember them by.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, and I'm sure that would be very well received, because you've been instrumental in lots of big, big tunes.
Very,
very much appreciated over here. I mean, is it just a UK phenomenon? Is it a Europe-wide phenomenon, or is it a... is your music, your 60s and 70s music, is that still in demand in America, or is it just here that it's appreciated?
You know, it's mostly, you know, I get a lot of, I'll tell you where it's selling. I'm getting a lot of attention in Australia market right now, and Japan is very strong.
Yes, Japan.
Japan is very strong. There's a group, I put Someday We're Gonna Love Again in the Google bar. I put Someday We're Gonna Love Again Japan. I think it was either YouTube. Yeah. And it came up, and there was a Japanese group on stage singing Someday We're Gonna Love Again.
Oh, fantastic.
And I said, is this real? I said, I think I need to go over there, too. So, no, the United States does not have the same appreciation for those songs, for that type of music. You know, over here, they just move from one groove to the next, one style to the next, you know, and they try to set a standard and say, well, this is what's happening now. This is the music of now. And then 5 years from now, there'll be some other new music that they're promoting, and they'll say, this is the music of now. But what I've noticed over in the UK is that, you guys, it's not about that. It's about what sounds good, feels good.
Oh,
and
that's right. You say feels, you know, good. Music's not something you listen to. It's something you feel.
You're right. You have to feel it. And if you feel it and like it, they still play a lot of the Motown things
here.
But people don't know that there was so much more going on besides Motown.
Yeah. Well, Motown was just one label amongst a whole host of others just in Detroit.
I mean, every city. There were thousands of labels in Detroit. Yeah. But when they say, well, we're going to do our 60s weekend, well, it's mostly all Motown songs.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with them except that they weren't the only one.
No, but they just got the right formula and a bit of marketing savvy behind them, haven't they? I mean, Barry Gordy's a businessman. Anyway, that's another story. I don't want to get into that.
And, you know, I just want to say that Ollie McLaughlin did come out here. He came out, and I think he was thinking about trying to come out and move out here. Because when I left, it broke his heart, really, when I left.
I'm sure.
He wanted to hold on to me so tightly, and it was time for me to go, you know. But he did come out to see me. I picked him up and brought him over to my house when I was living in West Hollywood, and we spent an afternoon together. And he was just asking me 1,000 questions. And we're sitting there, and guess who walks by? Otis of the Temptations.
Oh, right.
He walks by, and Ollie sees him outside, and he jumps out and goes outside, and he says, Otis, man, how you doing? And Otis just about fainted. But anyway, Ollie did have a little time out here with me, and I was happy to have that before, you know, before I heard that he had died. And
yeah, oh, bless.
I got to tell you, Tony Hester, Popcorn Wiley, Bob Babbitt, you know, Ollie, just everybody, Don Davis, Dion. I mean, I got no one to talk to on the phone, you know? I have no one to say, remember when we did this?
Yeah.
So.
But then you were so much younger than them as well, weren't you?
Yes, and I knew that probably that day would come.
Yeah.
Because I'm 12 and I'm hanging out with people that I considered old.
Of course,
these people are old. They're like 20, 25.
I remember turning 25 and deciding I was old.
I said, I'm with these old people.
Yeah.
But I really had a nice run. I appreciated the career. I appreciate being able that someone recognized that I had some talent, and that I'm happy that I had opportunity to be in the industry all this time, you know.
Yeah. Well, sounds like you've got somebody on the
phone. I have no regrets.
Well, we really appreciate your music legacy, thank you, and we really appreciate you making this phone call and spending your time with us on what is going to be a very sunny afternoon in sunny California.
Well, I'm waiting for the sun to come out because it's a little cloudy right now.
Right.
I'm looking at the mountains. I see a little fog, but they said maybe sun. I don't know. We're supposed to get rain tomorrow.
Oh, dear. Oh, it's raining here as well, if there's any consolation.
I'm up in the hills. I'm up in Altadena, which is the hillside above Pasadena.
Right.
So,
lovely.
Yeah,
very
that's
beautiful.
Where I am.
Very beautiful.
Yeah, it's really nice up here.
Okay, off air you were saying that when you came across to Cleethorpes a couple of years ago, there was a track that you would have loved to have played, Here Comes the Boy I Love.
Yeah, the two songs I didn't get to sing, and some of the fans were telling me, they said, why didn't you sing Love is Wonderful, and why didn't you... Well, those are the two songs that I recorded.
Yep.
All the other songs were recorded by other people.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to hear those two songs.
Lovely.
But, you know, AD and I went over the list and everything, and those were the songs that they chose, so those are the ones I did.
Okay. Lovely. Well, thank you very much for talking to us. congratulations on a glittering career, and best wishes for the future stuff. What, you know, your recording studio that you're about to go back into the studio.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to play you out now with one of those two tracks. Here Comes the Boy I Love. Thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you very much, Adi. Thank you. So thoughtful.
And
Neil.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Been great listening to
you. Yeah,
stories.
You guys, you should email me.
You will.
McMahon Pub. McMahonPub@AOL.com.
Yeah. Don't you worry about that. I'm already on it.
Okay.
I think you've got a new best friend. Right. Thanks very much, Sharon. Thanks for tuning in. There we go, ladies and gentlemen. Sharon McMahon.